Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. Tonight's program, Only Connect, Dramaturgy and Shakespeare's Living Theater, is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Our guests tonight are Dr. Philippa Kelly, resident dramaturge for the California Shakespeare Theater, and Jonathan Moscone, Artistic Director of California Shakespeare Theater and our moderator for tonight's program. We also have actress Anna Boulard and playwright Daniel Heath here to bring to life some excerpts from Romeo and Juliet. Dr. Philippa Kelly is a Shakespeare scholar and resident dramaturge for the California Shakespeare Theater. Her most recent book, The King and I, is a personal meditation on contemporary Australian life through the prism of King Lear. Dr. Kelly's work has been supported by many foundations and organizations, including the Fulbright and Rockefeller Foundations, the Walter and Eliza Hall Foundation, and the Commonwealth Awards. Besides her work for Cal Shakes, she currently teaches with the UC Berkeley Osher Institute, serves annually in the selection of the Australian Endeavor Awards and the Australian Prime Minister's Awards, and travels to Saudi Arabia to work with women in the higher education sector. Jonathan Moscone is in his 12th season as Artistic Director at California Shakespeare Theater. In 2010, he directed the world premiere of John Steinbeck's The Pastures of Heaven by Octavio Solis, which was a recipient of the inaugural NEA New Play Development Award. In 2011, he directed Ghostlight, a play he conceived and developed in collaboration with playwright Tony Taccone, the artistic director at the Berkeley Rep. The play made its debut at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and was produced earlier this year by the Berkeley Rep. His other Cal Shakes credits include The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby, Candida, Twelfth Night, Happy Days, and The Seagull. He is the first recipient of the Zelda Fitch Andler Award by the Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation for transforming the American theater through his unique and creative work. Mr. Moscone is a recipient of a Stanford Graduate School of Business Center for Social Innovation Fellowship, is an adjunct faculty member with ACT's MFA program, and sits on the board of Theater Communications Group. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Philippa Kelly and Jonathan Moscone.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming. It's my honor to be here with Anna Boulard, one of the treasures of the Cal Shakes stage, and I grew to love Anna the very first moment I met her when we were rehearsing Mrs. Warren's Profession. Daniel Heath, nationally performed playwright, and our own Jonathan Moscone, director, artistic director for Cal Shakes, ubiquitous spirit. Ian Forster's novel, Howard's End, has the famous epigraph, "Only Connect." Only connect. That was the whole of the sermon. Only connect the prose and the passion, and both will be exalted, and human love will be seen at its highest. Live in fragments no longer. Live in fragments no longer. Forster's epigraph calls to mind what we commonly do in approaching a work of art. We seek a kind of connection, a feeling that, as C.S. Lewis once put it, makes us know we're not alone. When we really feel that we understand a work of art, it's a touchstone, like a scent perhaps that wafts up through years of forgetting, or the whispering of curtains on a hot childhood afternoon, or the sensation, as I always get with the artist Jeffrey Smart, of being estranged in a familiar world. Art allows for connections between fragments of feeling, allowing them to mean something. The very condition of life is that nothing lasts forever. Bodies change, feelings change, thoughts change, relationships change. But in the face of all of this change, we constantly seek and seek again to connect up the pieces to make our experience amount to something we can understand. And now I give you Anna.
"'Tis but thy name that is my enemy. Thou art thyself, though not a Montague. What's Montague? It is nor hand, nor foot, nor arm, nor face, nor any other part belonging to a man. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name, would smell as sweet. So Romeo would, were he not Romeo called, retain that dear perfection which he owes without that title. Romeo, doff thy name, and for that name, which is no part of thee, take all myself."
"What's in a name?" asked the young girl in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, the play that we'll be seeing when I take some of you up to Ashland in June. Juliet is referring to Romeo Montague's name. Montague is a simple name or a piece of language that divides him from her. Juliet is suggesting that Romeo is who he is in his essence and that language doesn't box him in to who he has to be. In fact, language discolours him and divides him from his beloved. To hell with the name. The name doesn't matter. It's only his name that makes him a Montague. His name is a lid that declares him closed or unavailable. Take off the lid, and there you have it. Juliet's Romeo. Much as Juliet might mistrust the effect of language, the perfection she so prizes is indeed as ephemeral as is language itself. I think that the demise of the two young lovers, and this is something that I talked about a lot with John when we were doing the play for Cal Shakes a couple of years ago, this demise constitutes Shakespeare's metaphoric suggestion of this very truth. Romeo isn't perfect. It's just that Juliet thinks he is. The perfection of any one of us is always created, in a sense, by the person who loves us. While this doesn't make us less of a marvel in another's eyes, our perfection is essentially in and of the moment. That brief moment when, for the person who loves us, it all comes together. It's the moment for which we've apparently been waiting all our lives. Only connect. This is what makes it all make sense, this perfect love. The deaths of Romeo and Juliet constitute what I think is Shakespeare's ironic and poignant suggestion that such perfection can't last. It will change. We might die, as the young lovers do, or we might just get old and cranky and sit silently across from each other at the breakfast table. As the prologue to Romeo and Juliet suggests so poignantly and expressively, love in its first perfect bloom is death-marked, whether we die or whether we just get old and tired and unattractive. This doesn't make the love any the less, it just makes it human. Only connect, which brings me to the subject of dramaturgy, which is part of and a very important part of my professional life. Terry Eagleton has described meaning as the product of a transaction between us and reality. We've all got our own take on reality and we make our own meanings, moment by moment. A dramaturg is ideally a lithe and flexible conduit between these different takes on reality and indeed on art's relationship to reality itself. In rehearsal, a company comes together, some members returning, others for the first time, to explore the tones and subtle shades of a script in order to bring it to life on the stage. We can't envisage all of the possibilities for where a piece will go without getting a full sense of where it comes from and where it might head. A dramaturg aims to facilitate that breadth of vision by providing a depth of knowledge. And I guess in the past, such depth of knowledge has sometimes been a cubbyholed as pages of dead information which you have to get through before you get onto the real business of rehearsing, clucked out by a mother hen. But when dramaturgy is alive, I think you can get much more than this. Dramaturgy should be what I think of as a vein that runs through a living work. constantly exerting pressure, feeding the production, and responding as a reflex to what's being made. Part of a dramaturg's job is to understand the instability of language. We work with it every day, creating bridges for the makers of a production. We assist the director, the designer, the actors, connecting language, maybe as it was used then, to how it can be meaningful now. When the term was first coined in Germany, a dramaturg was really seen as a conservator. But the very act of conserving meaning is an implicit acknowledgement that words never, ever stay the same. Generally, a dramaturg doesn't have a lot to do directly with the audience. But when I began shaping my own life as a dramaturg with the California Shakespeare Theatre, I felt that there was something very open and accessible about the hills in which the theatre was built and also in the person of the artistic director. In its very architecture, it challenges the traditional borders between stage and seating. There is, of course, a theatre and seating. The structure has actually the exact dimensions of Shakespeare's globe, give or take a few centimetres. But the whole surroundings, the grove where I give pre-show talks, the picnic area, the amenities, the go-karts that whiz wheelchair travellers up and down the hill at the speed of light, the blankets given out for audience members to wrap themselves in, all of these features enfold the audience in a communal atmosphere that I feel makes the act of conversation natural. So I deliver many of the pre-show talks myself, and I host all of the talkbacks. I moderate the pre-production information sections between Jonathan, cast, crew, and I run a blog called Ask Philippa, to which audience members can direct thoughts and questions about any given production. This amount of dramaturgical involvement might not feel right in another theatre, but it feels right for me and for where I am at Cal Shakes in the Arinda Hills with our loyal audiences who come back each summer to experience the magic of Shakespeare in the midst of nature. But I want to go on more specifically into the dramaturg's part in creating a living Shakespeare. Quite a bit about the role is very detailed, and here Anna will give us some more lines from Romeo and Juliet.
Give me my Romeo, and when I shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night.
The first two lines begin, as you could tell, on a trochee, an emphatic first word which runs counter to normal human speech. Normal human speech is da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. When Anna says, give me my Romeo, there's an urgency, an emphatic yearning, and then the words so fine resonate deeply, and a dramaturg would think about them. Fine from the French was coined in England in the mid-13th century. It derived from finish, complete, perfected, and it indicated something rare and unblemished. He will make it so fine. Something made in this world, but untarnished by the world. Like Romeo's image in Juliet's gaze, like Juliet's love for Romeo. And so, cut into little stars, Romeo will make the very sun look tasteless and brash. But what about the words, I shall die? Most of you would know that there isn't a single one of Shakespeare's manuscripts except his will extant today. So what do we do about the fact that some editors of Romeo and Juliet have decided that Shakespeare wrote, I shall die, while others have decided that he meant he shall die? I shall die was actually authorised by Heming and Condell, two much loved and trusted members of Shakespeare's acting ensemble who collected his entire works after his death. How much Heming and Condell actually contributed to the alteration of Shakespeare's text is unknown. We don't even know whether they supervised the different printers who printed out the plays. What we do know is that there isn't there is not only the possibility that they contributed to the play scripts, but also that the various printeries that each play went through on its way through the press also contributed editings, modifications, what they would have seen as amendments. So given all of these variables, isn't it easy to imagine that Shakespeare's original "When He Shall Die" became "When I Shall Die"? Or, more shocking to some, that Shakespeare, who apparently never blotted a line, may indeed have made a mistake. He may have written "I" when he meant to write "he," or he may have dictated "I" and somebody took down "he." If Juliet is talking about seeing the dead Romeo cut up into little stars, "He shall die" makes sense. We all have a horror of our loved ones suddenly being wiped off the face of the earth. And we all want to believe that death isn't final. But what about if we accept the version, "I shall die"? What's that about? Juliet dying and then somehow seeing Romeo still on earth cut up into little stars? This is when the dramaturg's interest in context and in the ever-predictable unpredictability of words comes into play. "Die" in Shakespeare's time actually also meant orgasm. So we can picture this inexperienced young girl who's about to tell us further in her speech that she's gotten a mansion but not yet possessed it, imagining herself orgasming and seeing stars over to Anna.
I have no comment to add to that, other than Juliet's lines. "Oh, I have bought the mansion of a love, but not possessed it, and though I am sold, not yet enjoyed. So tedious is this day as is the night before some festival to an impatient child that hath new robes and may not wear them."
So then the dramaturg goes to Jonathan Moscone and asks, "What do you want? A Juliet from the purest and most poignant love story ever told? Or the fleshly Juliet who can't wait to get into bed with her first serious boyfriend?" Always, this is a fascinating question, because that world, Shakespeare's world, isn't hermetically sealed in a vacuum. It comes to us. It grows with us. It's part of who we are, and we, the cast and crew, shape what it can be for us. So really, I think the dramaturg looks under the skin of a production and threads the vein of a living knowledge. She tries to make available or clear some possibilities for how the organs of the show could work. You need to know the skeleton of a play's history in order to get some sense of how the blood can pump through the organs in this particular incarnation. It's the director who decides how the show will work. The dramaturg needs to be really clear about where her boundaries are. A dramaturg's role is not to tell a director what she feels is right or wrong as an interpretation, but rather to give a history of what kinds of interpretations might have been made, how a particular character's journey might flow if you choose this or that orientation, how the transition will be if you make a cut to these lines or those or even to a whole scene. Part of the healthy functioning of such a mechanism or body of work is also in the context that a dramaturg provides for crew, cast, and audiences. So I prepare actors' packets for every show. No one's tested on them, of course. But for instance, when I'm preparing a packet on Romeo and Juliet, I might talk about how Shakespeare chose Verona as the location for the play. Verona is hot. And so young men from Verona were known as hot-blooded. I will talk about the normal marriage age for young women and men in Italy at that time. Just in case you're interested, Italian brides of the upper classes were very carefully controlled by their fathers, as were the English ones. In Italy, by the age of 7, these girls had often been promised by their fathers either in marriage or to the convent, depending on how physically attractive they were. The girls designated for marriage would often live in the convent until their weddings, which would take place generally at the age of 16 or 17. And girls promised to the convent would begin the process of taking the vow from age 9, and then more seriously at the age of 13. So when Friar Lawrence kindly offers to extract Juliet from her sticky situation after Romeo's death by getting her into a convent, in the Italy that Shakespeare writes about, this would have been quite a plausible alternative to a marriage plan gone bad. So this is all really useful to know for a director and the actors, because then choices become more fully understood. In my actor packet, I'll also talk about the verse structure of the play and how this works. For instance, Romeo and Juliet famously makes use of the sonnet, which is the world's most famous poetic love form, as a way of framing and holding the lovers' first meeting. Listen to this exchange between Romeo and Juliet, and really listen.
If I profane with my unworthiest touch hand this holy shrine, the gentle fine is this, my lips two blushing pilgrims ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much, which mannerly devotion shows in this. For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Have not saints' lips and holy palmer's too?
Aye, pilgrim. Lips that they must use in prayer.
Well, then, dear saint, let lips do what hands do, they pray. Grant thou lest faith turn to despair.
Saints do not move, though grant for prayer's sake.
Then move not, while my prayer's effect I take.
The sonnet is, in a sense, provides a verbal form for the lovers' relationship. It begins with the lovers having a stanza each, and then it gets more and more accelerated in excitement until the lovers are almost panting in a rapid exchange of one-liners. A scholar, Peter Groves, has noted beautifully that the movement of the sonnet towards its epigrammatic or brief conclusion writes out, in a sense, the lovers moving together and entwining, so the lines entwine as the lovers' bodies will. It's as if the lines are a metaphor, a living verbal metaphor for the lovers' physical union. I'll also talk about other things like character issues, the role of the friar. Is he a well-meaning offender, or is he simply benign? An actor's backstory about the friar's motives will affect how he wants to play him and how he is directed as a part of the cast. And so Jonathan will have a conversation with the friar as to how he sees his role, informed by whatever I can supply about friars in that time. Then there are other issues like the knife that Juliet lays down just before she drinks the friar's potion. Where does Juliet plausibly get a hold of a knife? Does she intend to kill herself if she can't fall into a deathlike trance? And although she sets the knife down, it disappears evidently because nobody finds it after she's apparently dead. So where does Juliet put it after she's talked about it? Under the bed? Shakespeare may not have worked these questions through fully. His plays were staged very quickly. He was doing 3, sometimes 4 in a year in the active years when the theatres weren't shut down because of the plague. And he relied on his actors to improvise as they went. And this is something useful for you to know about Shakespeare. In his time, almost every acting company just disbanded and reformed with other members. All the time. Actors were workmen paid 6 pence a day to do what they did. Shakespeare's company was different. Because his plays were so financially successful, his actors stayed with him. And so he got this incredible band of actors who stayed with him for year after year. And of course, in those years when he wrote Hamlet, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, then we know that there were 2 special actors he had who, because on the English stage, all of the female parts were played by males, and those actors stayed feminine long beyond the time when a boy's voice normally broke, and so he could write these very complicated and beautiful parts for women. So he really was working with the talent he had to hand, and the talent he had to hand wanted to stay with him. So all of this, I can provide that kind of information in an extemporary fashion to a company. But anyway, back to the dagger. If we leave in Juliet's line about the dagger, we need to make a plausible reason as to why she has it and why a modern audience might see it disappear from sight. Well, looking under the skin of a production is natural for somebody who looks under the skin of a culture. And I fully believe that I could not have written my book, The King and I, had I not been working with Cal Shakes, because Cal Shakes has really helped me to think much more clearly as of theatre as alive. In my latest book, The King and I talk about, I guess, some essential features that I see about Australian culture, but which can actually apply to any culture: abandonment, loneliness, people in prison, people of colour, the way in which we segment off parts of society, but what it feels like to be in those segments. And the astonishing thing about King Lear is that here we have a king, the foremost in the land, who suddenly, at the age of 80 years and upward, has to learn what it feels to be abandoned, to be lonely, to be not thought about, and actually simply to be a man. Most of us learn what it means to be simply human by the age of 2 or 3. But for him, he reaches the age of 80 before this happens. And so in The King and I try to talk about that act of awakening. Things like, you may be taken to the heath, a place of loneliness and deprivation. That doesn't mean that you will have an enormous journey of revelation and discovery. In order to be on the heath and to really learn something about yourself, you need a couple of people at least around who can remind you of who you were and are. And so when I talk about prisons and people who've been abandoned by society, what I believe is that they don't have anyone around to remind them of who they were and who they are. And so the most important thing is presenting a story that is plausible about yourself. Going to the heath and going on an inner journey of discovery is something not affordable. So all of those issues I talk about in light of Australian society and about actually Australian society is really just a window through which we look at ourselves, I guess, in any Western society, the choices we are given and the choices we make. It's been an honour to give the formal part of this talk, brought so alive by Anna and Daniel. So now I will move to the chair and begin the second part.
Before I open this up, but there's a line. What's in a name? Unless I'm wrong, just because this is on radio or podcast, it won't be preserved for centuries. Anna, you pronounce your last name Bullard.
Oh, I'm not proprietary about the way my name is pronounced.
I am. So if I were you, I would do so as well.
I've been called many things in many different times, so I've just learned.
But in terms of people hearing this 100 years from now and seeing our society.
For my parents sitting in the audience tonight, it is indeed Bullard.
Are your parents here?
They are.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
I'm Jonathan Moscone, and our thanks to Dr. Philippa Kelly. I love calling her doctor, Dr. Philippa Kelly. And you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. We have some time for audience questions, and I am going to start with one that I'm going to actually ask the person who wrote it to read it, because Your writing is very hard to read, and yet it's very complicated and has something to do with taking the last course and about fathers. Who wrote this?
Oh, I'm sorry, my brain.
No, why don't you go to the... No, it's a fantastic question. I just don't want to mess it up. So if you don't mind asking it, it also has Shakespearean quotes in it, and if I get those wrong, that's pretty much the end of my career. Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, let's see. Some of us took a course with Philippa and recently, and we talked a little bit about fathers and daughters in Shakespeare. And so since we were talking about Romeo and Juliet, I wonder if Philippa or anybody would have maybe something to say about, for example, three fathers, old Capulet in this play, who in Act One looks like a doting father who... is, I forget the line, but he doesn't want his daughter, who hasn't seen 14 years yet, to marry Paris, at least until he's wooed her for 2 years. And then suddenly, in Act Three, something happens to him. He's a different person. He turns into a tyrant who says, she'll be married in 2 days, and I'll drag the hurdle to the church. That was one example. And then I was thinking of Aegis in... Midsummer, when Hermia wants... She's independent. She doesn't want to marry the man her father wants her to. And he says something like, and I don't remember exactly, but I beg the ancient rite of Athens, and since she is my daughter, I will dispose of her. And so her choices are the nunnery, death, or marrying someone she doesn't love or want to be near at all. And then there's Lear and Cordelia, and... You know, they love each other, and something erupts, and it's just horrible.
So what
triggers this? What triggers in these fathers something that is calling to maybe for the death of the child that they had just moments ago been doting on?
So that's a really interesting question for a dramaturg. And what I would say is, firstly, it makes you wonder about Shakespeare's own life. He had two daughters, one who was born 6 months after his marriage, and the other who was part of a set of twins, and the boy twin died at the age of 11. But interestingly, he always favoured the older, semi-illegitimate daughter. So all through his own life, he's got this fascination, certainly through his writing life, it's a fascination from Aegeus in the very early 1590s right through until, you know, Cymbeline in 1611, a fascination with the violent act of separation between a father and a daughter, how a father reacts to that, the journey that the father has to go on in order to somehow come to terms with that act of separation. And of course, it's such a contemporary theme, and these plays being written 400 years before Freud got his hands on them. So it's a very interesting question.
Well, I mean, there's part of it, if you were to sort of subtract the Freudian questions out of it, which may not have been in his head, or they may have been, who knows? But, you know, what Shakespeare did, you know, and you do this in Winter's Tale, why does he do that? Why does Iago do what he does? I mean, in some ways, what's great about Shakespeare and what seems to elude most of us as American dramatists and writers is he didn't really care why. He just needed to set the play in dramatic motion. He needed to push someone off a cliff at the start, in the first scene. So, yeah. Yeah, Aegeus doesn't want her to do what it's supposed to do. You can come with all these reasons why that kind of world exists, and that's great. But, you know, the point is, push her off a cliff so she makes all the wrong choices.
And interesting...
Why does Leontes do what he does? Because Polixenes touches the pregnant... I mean, there are whatever reasons you give, there's no justification for the way he behaves. He just has to do it in order for the play to go on its massive adventure. Yeah. And you gotta love that. I mean, that's rollicking playwriting, and which is sort of takes causality and sort of throws it out the window and says, that's what you do. Step it up, do it, push her off the cliff, and then we'll do the play. They're almost the first scenes of every play. So I love that about it. And, you know, it's pretty much easy for a dad to do that to his daughter, so you can buy into that on some level. I'm not saying you want my daughter to die, but, you know, if they make a mistake, there's a, you know, he said, oh, I always love how he set plays in Italy because he's just like, the Italians are hot-blooded. You know, or like, or the great, you know, he always said it in that a different way just to get some kind of cultural justification for the behavior. Like the Italian Sicilian father who basically kills, you know, his wife over jealousy, which is, you see that now in The Sopranos. I mean, it's like a complete setup based on a cliche, based on stereotypes, which he worked from, to make something really complex happen. A two-dimensional concept making something superbly three-dimensional happen.
And actually, just structurally, in terms of what John's saying, if you look at all of Shakespeare's plays, the mothers are either very sort of sketchy, very non-warm characters, or they are characters who are killed off or put on ice or baked into a statue for the next 16 years. They're either that or they're not present at all. And so then we think, why is that? It's partly to support what Jonathan say, push somebody off a cliff and see what happens. But also think of these young boys playing the female parts. You actually couldn't have a lot of complexity during most of his writing life written into those older female parts because there's too much of a disparity between age and gender. So Shakespeare took what was a practical problem and made it into a thematic, fantastic thing that take away the mother and there's no longer that force, that very shaping force that keeps the daughter under control. Suddenly the daughter can blossom and find this breadth of personality.
That's great. This is a good question. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be, well, I probably shouldn't say it, but I'm supposed to be interviewing Kenneth Branagh. And I've been listening, reading up on him. And he got nominated for Best
Supporting Actor.
Yeah. That's okay, thanks. Adapted screenplay for Hamlet for an Academy Award. Like, what to be or not to do? I mean, what did he do? What did he adapt? What part did he adapt? I was sort of fascinated by the adaptation that, you know, it's like, oh, that was great work. You made that better. stunning. But when does a Shakespeare play or other artwork become an adaptation or a truly a different play? Example, Measure for Measure. I'm assuming what that MM means, right? Measure for Measure. Last year performed at Ashland. At Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
I didn't see that Measure, but I heard great things about it. What did you feel? Did you feel it was an adaptation, or did you feel it was...
Well, I so well remember California Shakespeare doing Measure for Measure a few years back, and I was turned off the Measure for Measure. Barry Craft, normally, when he's behind a production, I know it's going to be great, and he was the dramaturge on Measure for Measure, but it was a modern production.
This was at Ashland.
So are you talking about textual adaptation, or are you talking about...
Well, in Julius Caesar...
Visual interpretation.
...a part as Julius Caesar.
Right.
You know, what...
changing lines in the play.
Yeah. It's a tricky question, because an adaptation is basically when you have a memory of a text that is behind what is performed. So, for instance, you can have a very strong memory and you can adhere very closely to what the playwright had, or you can actually be quite distant. And so, say, with Passages of Heaven that we did 2 years ago at Calshakes, there was John Steinbeck's text quite a bit behind what was made by Octavio Solis, although 70% of the lines were from Steinbeck, but it was a novel adapted into a screenplay. So what I say is that there's a memory of the text. Generally with Shakespeare, because there's no copyright, it's more than 70 years since Shakespeare died, then if you've got a play generally it will be, unless you chop and change and reassort scenes all over the place, it'll generally be not scripted as an adaptation, although a purist would say, wow, that was an adaptation. Verona, that was done, the Verona project done at Cal Shakes last year, that was definitely an adaptation.
I think it was just a new play. I think she just took the play and said at one point she thought, I can't adapt this. I'm taking it outside of its own identity. So she dropped that identity, and which was fine, and went into another identity. You know, back in the 1800s, you know, Shakespeare was rewritten where every play ended happily. Juliet got back up and lived. I hesitate to say this, but we all have to acknowledge that every decade, every generation, everyone in the world has adapted Shakespeare, period. And for us, if I did an all-guy production of Shakespeare, people would thought I was doing an all-gay production of it. In fact, I would be something more purist. And if someone were, if I were to do actually full modern, full Renaissance dress, that would actually be 19th century. They didn't do full Renaissance dress then. So it's actually, we're our understanding of what we think is pure, or, and I'm not sure that I don't think that's what your question was, or adapted, is a really complex question that is not about the visual signifiers as we know them. I'm going to move on to these other questions. There seems to be a lot of tension up there on stage. No, there seems to be a lot of tension between the way John Moscone somethings the play. My goodness, people. What do you wrote? What's that? Right? What? Envisions the play? Envisions the play? The play is the thing. And Philippa Kelly's much more analytical approach to the writing. More analytical. Is there tension in your discussions pre-production? Oh, God. Yes. There is the next question. There is speculation that Shakespeare, that's the tension, right? That's the whole point. That's the wonderful tension. She's not there to support.
Yeah, I want to go back to this because, you know, one can be a mother hen, say, oh, Jonathan, that evacuation was fantastic. Or you can say, hey, John, when you say that, how does that impact? The second is actually what he wants. It's harder to give because you put your identity as a dramaturg on the line, but I think it's a really interesting change that's coming over the role of dramaturgy over the last decade, that actually directors want dramaturgs who ask questions that stop them and make them think,
And really, at the end of the day, despite what the doctor said, dramaturgs offer their opinions all the time. Yeah. That's what they're in the room for. They're human beings. They're not books. They're not walking books. They read a certain thing to interpret a certain way, and that's what they are responding to. And you have another smart person in the room. And for her to ask me the question, which Juliet am I interested in that conversation about dying, and a dramaturg was the first one to tell me that dying was about orgasms, which connected then up with sneezing, which is also similar to an orgasm, which your heart stops. I was like, it all makes sense because I like sneezing a lot. It seems to me, of course, she has no idea she's going to die. She has no concept of dying. Mm-hmm. She doesn't even think about it. They didn't even think about it until it happens. And then they do it, they don't even know it's happening. I mean, these are 13-year-olds. They don't have any idea. So it made total sense. And everything about that sentence is about, I need to have sex, which is what drives a lot of that in the play, which is kind of great. And if you read your Shakespeare, the man knew his sex, right? There, I mean, we could do a whole piece about that, a whole discussion. There is speculation that, speaking of sex, there is a speculation that Shakespeare was a closet Catholic. Do you take this into account regarding the meaning of words and morals?
That's an easy question for me to answer. I think that there's a lot of speculation that he was actually a Catholic in a Protestant time. I believe that he was a magpie and that he took up various motifs of Catholicism and made them part of the engine, the hot button that he would push. And so that's what everything was for Shakespeare, grist for his mill.
And how I understood Much Ado About Nothing when I did it several years ago was as a Catholic. When I understood that as the need for someone to die in order for them to rise to cleanse the sins. I completely understood. Because you're thinking, what kind of plan is that?
Everybody at that time was an ex-Catholic.
And the one who comes up with the plan is the priest. That's his plan. And it works. So I think there's a definite way of reading a lot of Shakespeare's plays through that lens. And I think it's really fantastically interesting because a lot of it is coded. And sometimes, depending on when he wrote the play, when it was free to talk about it, he talks about it more openly. Mm-hmm. Is there any knowledge about Shakespeare, an Englishman, based so much of his work? Oh, is there any knowledge about why Shakespeare, an Englishman, based so much of his work in Italy?
Really, for the censors, censors, that it was very probable that if you said anything that incited the wrath of the regent, you would get your hand or your ear chopped off or lose your life. Said it in Italy, suddenly you're free. And say with Romeo and Juliet, what's wonderful about setting it in Italy is you have Catholicism all around you there, and you have a convent to possibly send Juliet to. In England, monasteries were all destroyed by Henry VIII. So there's always structural and practical life-saving reasons and thematic reasons.
Yeah. We know so little. There's a great book, is it Bill Bryson's book about...
Yeah.
I forget. It's a quite quick read about how much we know about Shakespeare, which is essentially nothing.
Yeah.
Zero. There's no information on him. There's even no information on the Globe. That was actually never drawn. There was a theater like the Globe that some Danish guy drew. So it's actually no... That was figured out. They guessed on that, which I thought was interesting. Which also, it's actually his way of supporting the belief that Shakespeare was the author. Because we have no proof that he didn't. So you can't prove that he didn't. So I thought that was really kind of interesting. Great legal mind. Given, this is a tough one. Given all the problems we're facing in the world today, what is the present relevance of Shakespeare's plays to the human condition?
Easy one to answer.
Slam dunk.
Shakespeare is all about metaphor. So you think of, say, Othello. No matter what's happening in Afghanistan, Othello still falls in love, is desperately vulnerable. So you feel those metaphors. For there where I have garnered up my heart, the fountain from the which my current springs. We all know how vulnerable it is. It makes you to fall in love. Or that feeling in Macbeth, for I am in blood steeped so far that should I go no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. So those metaphors that go to the heart of human experience, they're what Shakespeare is famous for, not his plots. He borrowed most of those. It's the metaphor and the way he shapes it.
And I think what makes his work enduring and adaptable and ever capable of having a little bit of light shone on upon it by any particular time or place is every single character. You know, when you're working on it, you say, well, I do this in one scene, then I'm like that in the next scene. And I said, well, all Shakespeare was so, you know, someone wrote to me, a playwright, that Shakespeare wrote humans at their fullest, which is saying their most contradictory self. And there is such a dimensionality to the writing of humanity that supersedes so many plays that it always takes me back to what Martha Nussbaum said, which is the test of any civilization is its ability to understand and embrace ambiguity, which Shakespeare does all through his plays. So actually, its relevance is the fact that they're the most complex examples of what it means to live. They're not prescriptive, they're not black and white, they're not right or wrong, they're not morality plays, they are human experiences. So as a metaphor for how the world could work, Shakespeare remains as relevant in our jobs in the making of it, as we make it, is to reflect that relevance in any given moment.
And actually, that reminds me that when I was listening to Anna reading those lines, part of the beauty of great acting is to say those lines as if you've never read them before, and you feel that chill up your spine.
Mm-hmm. This is a beautiful question. In contemporary American culture, as opposed to so many others. Their theater is seen by most as an expendable commodity, a business, not a cultural necessity or part of a person's education. How do theaters today respond to give meaning to this oft overlooked and underrated art form? Is this another easy one?
I think that's a Moscone slam dunk.
Oh, you're throwing it back. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, next question.
What about your educational outreach that you've done? I mean, that's certainly a...
I'm just trying to read this. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it is felt that way to be an expendable. You see in funding for the foundation of all arts and creative thinking is in arts education, and that has just almost dwindled to zero in California as one of the saddest examples of that, despite the fact that it is mandated in every school. 11% actually perform arts education work. So if it's not there, it's not going to happen later on in life. So how do theaters respond? We fill that need. Mm-hmm. We take that on. We take that issue on. How do we think about it in another way, such as the vast numbers of people who make theater or make art in a completely newly democratized form of storytelling, which is blogging. Blogging is like so 1997, that's that term, but everything that people do when they make now is democratized beyond our wildest imaginations. So how do theaters, which, depending on who you are as a theater, can basically be in a big, big house? Now, my friends at the American Conservatory Theater have to fill an over 1,100-seat house. So whatever is being worked on there has to fill that house. And if they don't, they have to find that money elsewhere. So what Carrie is doing, Perloff, is working to integrate into a community that needs to, that is hoping to develop itself in order to find more viable and open spaces to do work. So where we do our work as theaters is how we respond to this, and who participates and how they participate. Mm. And this is beyond the concept of engagement and outreach. It started with that, and that's a good thing. This is about the move that the culture is in America is being funded towards, which is more participatory arts culture, where we as organizations engage beyond, bring people in beyond engagement towards participation. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean we're going to have like community theaters on stage at ACT? Not if Carrie has anything to say about it, but if what does it mean? That's the question that every theater has to face right now. And you, and there are people who have gone out of their way to brazenly say, we don't need to see another Shakespeare play. Mm-hmm. And I went to a school just a couple weeks ago, and somebody had just spoken before me and said that Shakespeare is dead. And I just like, and there was 15 students, and expletives came out of my mouth. I said, that's what he would like to think. And I said, if he doesn't, that's like saying somebody who pretends that their life that led up to right now doesn't matter towards their future. And Philippa talked about that. And yeah, I'm not interested in Shakespeare for historical sake. I'm interested in understanding where we've been so I can understand where we are to see where we're going. And if we as theaters make that continued link, Shakespeare will go on forever. If it doesn't happen, it will become an old museum. And that's our job as theater makers, right? And doing that, bringing the past into the present towards the future. And there are many ways of doing that. So that's my answer.
Yeah, that's a wonderful answer, if I may be so curatorial. interestingly, you know...
You may.
My husband, Paul Drescher, and I often talk about this, because we both work in the arts, that you don't go into the arts in order to make big bucks. You basically are in it because you're passionate about it. And say with Anna and Daniel, they afford their life in the theatre by running a technology company called Giant Rabbit. And for myself, I do a lot of work in Australia and Saudi Arabia, things that pay bigger bucks so that I can work with my passion in the theater. And we all make it work because something in us has to do it.
I also take it as an organizational leader to make it possible for people to actually make a living in the theater and to create opportunities for people who don't have power to gain power as in terms of earning potential, straight up earning potential to make a job in the arts or to use their artistic education to creatively imagine a job for themselves. And the great thing is the convergence that we are facing in this world is that there's the dot-com has been replaced by social innovation, entrepreneurialism, and that's a creative field. So I think we have a great, great opportunity there. So we are here done with these written down questions. Are there any questions that people have that they want to ask up at the mic?
Because we have 1 minute, so you have to run to the mic.
We have a little more than 1 minute. We have 5 minutes. We have 9 minutes. Talk slowly. What is the elephant?
That was my gift to Anna and Daniel because they have just gotten engaged.
I trained at the Yale School of Drama, or as I like to call it, Thespis's House of Horrors. I'm so glad that got recorded. And they taught this concept of dueling dramaturgy, where the director would always have two dramaturgs on the production to argue points. I know, that was my reaction. And I was aghast at that. I thought, oh my goodness, I mean, is that how shockingly patriarchal was that statement? I said, I don't need them to argue a point and then I pick what I like. Yeah. I love, every time I walk up, this is what being in a drama situation with a dramaturg is. You go up, you think you're making something happen, you're like, oh, it's bum, bum, I'm bam, bam, they're making it happen, happen, happen. This, great, great, great. And you turn around and she's like this.
Yeah. Or what about the knife?
And then I come in and she says, you know what's really interesting? And they tell me this really interesting story. I'm like, oh. Make some tea. You know, you just, because you are reminded that as far as you go out on that limb, that there's another conversation to be had.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, you know, and that happens in that moment. So, and what about that knife? I remember we had that conversation about the knife. I was like, just get rid of the knife. Where'd you get the knife? I don't know. Just you have it. Like, I mean, I could write a little scene. You know, I could say, you know, like a little kind of a jump cut to the kitchen. You know, when the cook is moving away and she just grabs the knife. You know, she just, that the whole idea about her not knowing where the knife comes is, the audience should go, what the? Where did she get that knife? What is she doing with that knife? Oh, my God. She's going to threaten herself. That's where your experience should be. You shouldn't know where that knife came from, because then you'd be like, oh, I know where that knife came from. He was a pure, like, massive populist storyteller. That's what the great thing about him was. And that's why I also think he'll always be relevant. If you really do it upright, Shakespeare could just be ridiculously entertaining. Yeah. Just entertaining. What a great story. Yeah. You know, I wish everything I saw had that much drama or comedy or ambition in its storytelling that this writer provided for us, and that someone like her can extrapolate her views on an entire society through him. And we are very lucky at Cal Shakes, as we are in the Bay Area, to have the doctor.
I feel like the lucky one, and just to have you here with me tonight, John, Anna, Daniel, helping me to make this an evening that I will remember all my life, and having you here, it's a huge honor.
These are your fans. Let's give it up for Dr. Kelly.
Our thanks to all of you and to our audiences online. And thank you to Dr. Philippa Kelly, Jonathan Moscone, Daniel, oh my gosh.
Heath.
Daniel Heath and Anna Bullard. And tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Christina Namath, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.